This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, August 6th. Sitting in for Verna Avery Brown, I'm Matt Martin. Talk of an Israeli hit list and Palestinian retaliation as violence surges in the Middle East. Dr. King's eldest son fights to maintain leadership of the SCLC. Critics say he's ineffective. And would you mind eating from a spoon made from irradiated scrap metal?
It's your obligation to segregate this material. So the statement by Doe that it's low level, just knock that off. We're not interested in hearing from Doe about what's low level. There is no safe dose of radiation.
We'll have a report. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Irish Republican Army has proposed a method which they say will put its weapons completely and verifiably beyond use. This just hours before the major Protestant party, the Ulster Unionists, gathered to discuss how to respond to a British-Irish plan unveiled last week. Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams said the disarmament proposal demonstrates the IRA's commitment to search for lasting peace. But the Democratic Unionists called the proposal a further delaying tactic to gain more concessions. In the Mexican state of Tabasco, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, won the governor's race, chalking up its first electoral victory since losing its seven-decade grip on power to President Vicente Fox. Travis Lee reports from Mexico City.
Yesterday's vote in the Southern Gulf state was the second run of that election, since the results of the original vote were tossed out by the courts for fraud. Manuel Andrade won the election with over 50% of the vote, followed by a coalition led by the center-left Party of the Democratic Revolution, the PRD, with about 46%. Andrade, a 35-year-old lawyer from the party which ruled Mexico for 71 years, the PRI, said the vote this time was indisputably clean and honest, but the PRD reports irregularities in 10 of the state's 17 municipalities. PRD militants say PRI members stole ballot boxes, coerced voters, bought votes, and even kidnapped and beat three local PRD leaders. The PRD-led coalition is meeting to discuss the irregularities. In Mexico City, I'm Travis Lee for Free Speech Radio News.
A new $15 billion International Monetary Fund loan to Brazil will put that country's debt to well over 50% of its gross domestic product. Josh Chafin is in Rio de Janeiro.
Brazilian markets improved on the news of the IMF loan, but some economists fear it won't be enough to keep Argentina's problems from creeping northward. Government economists are applauding the IMF action, but the conditions of the loan have yet to be announced publicly. When Brazil took a loan from the IMF in 1998, it was required to relax many of its environmental protections. Brazilian grassroots activists say the people and the environment of the Amazon will suffer as a result of the IMF loan. Leftist critics say the loan increases the chance of a win for their candidate in next year's presidential election. According to economists, Brazil's debt is now over 50% of its gross domestic product. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Josh Chaffin in Rio de Janeiro.
Dutch authorities have hired a contractor to begin construction on the world's first permanent international criminal court. The Bush administration is refusing to ratify the treaty that established the court. Plans for the new court are moving forward, with or without the United States. Geraldine Coughlin is in The Hague.
The Coalition for an International Criminal Court looks forward to the new institution as a cathedral of justice for the 21st century. The court will try individuals for war crimes when national courts are unwilling or unable to do so. The Bush administration argues that the treaty leaves U.S. soldiers vulnerable to politically motivated prosecutions. Benjamin Ferencz, the leading U.S. prosecutor during the Nuremberg trials of Nazi war criminals after World War II, said American opposition could have serious consequences for the court and that the U.S. could become a place of refuge for major war criminals. But supporters of the court hope that once it starts operating, the Americans will lend their support to the first instrument of global justice. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Geraldine Coughlin at The Hague.
The change of power in the Senate has created a financial windfall for Senate Democrats. Gareth Schweitzer reports from Washington.
New Federal Election Commission reports show that numerous prominent Democrats, such as Tom Harkin, John Edwards, and Majority Leader Tom Daschle, raised at least half of their 2001 campaign money in the month and a half since James Jeffords left the Republican Party. According to Larry Makinson of the Center for Responsible Politics, these changes of financial allegiance are common with shifts of power.
There are strategic donors out there who are watching which way the wind blows, and as the wind direction changes, their campaign contributions change as well. They'll still be giving money to Republicans, but they'll be giving a higher proportion to Democrats.
Others, such as Larry Klayman of Judicial Watch, take the more cynical view that these contributions, regardless of the party, represent the purchase of political clout by special interests.
What these parties are doing is that they are representing the special interest. They are representing the rich fat cat, the elite, that can line their pockets.
From Washington, D.C., I'm Gareth Schweitzer for Free Speech Radio News.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
The Israelis and Palestinians have both issued warnings that hint at more bloodshed to come, setting back hopes for calm amid a surge in Mideast violence. Israel published a list of 7 main terrorists it wants arrested by the Palestinian Authority, with the implication that they could be targeted for attack if they remain free. And Marwan Barghouti, a prominent Palestinian who was nearly hit by an Israeli missile over the weekend, said on Monday that no place in Israel was immune from attack. This seemingly unending cycle of bloodshed and threats for more violence swirl amid less publicized efforts toward peace and reconciliation. Free Speech Radio News correspondent Raphael Kraft is spending time with one such movement and files this report.
I'm an Israeli activist for many years, so I come to this demonstration.
What for?
I want to protest the war and show that not all the Israeli public supports genocide against Palestinians. I hope that with efforts like ours, people will become more optimistic.
Charles was among the 10,000 people that gathered Saturday night in Tel Aviv's Yitzhak Rabin Plaza before marching to the Defense Ministry to protest against Ariel Sharon's policy of repression. The procession was organized by the moderate Israeli organization Peace Now and the Peace Coalition, composed of the Meretz Left Liberal Party, the Labour Party, and various radical left movements. The demonstrators chanted, "Peace yes, occupation no." Absent from the Israeli political scene since the start of the Intifada, torn apart by Ehud Barak's humiliation in February elections and by Shimon Peres' participation in Ariel Sharon's coalition government, the Israeli left has not managed to mobilize such a great amount of people since the beginning of the clashes last September. Lost among moderate pacifist slogans, a yes to the right of return painted on a streamer was indicating the presence of the radical left in the rally.
There is a big distance in between radical left and normal left. And they're demonstrating together now.
Gila Flint is an independent radical peace activist.
Yes, because it's a moment of emergency. People feel that it's on the verge of the explosion. So they come together to demonstrate.
Uri Avneri, president of the association Gush Shalom, the peace bloc, was also part of the demonstration. He is among the most prominent representatives of the radical left in Israel.
Today was very obvious in this demonstration was that the public was much more radical than the speakers. I think it was very, very encouraging. It shows that the usual process of movements of this kind, first the radical part of the movement speaks out and says loudly what other people don't dare to say. And then slowly the mass of the movement follows and repeats half or quarter of what we have been saying all the time.
Recently released polls show 70% of the Israelis in favor of Ariel Sharon's policy toward the Palestinians. However, according to Uri Avneri, the polls hide new realities in the Israeli opinion.
If you read carefully the public opinion polls, they show there is a very big majority for Sharon. There's also a big majority for giving back East Jerusalem. And there's also a big majority for dismantling the settlement for peace. It's not unequivocal message. People are sending a mixed message. They want Sharon and they want peace.
It seems today that Israelis still want a general as their leader, but expect from him courageous decisions on the way to peace, such as Menachem Begin took in 1982 when he ordered to withdraw from Sinai. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Raphael Kraft in Tel Aviv.
The U.S. Department of Energy has announced its intention to prepare a programmatic environmental impact statement on policy alternatives for disposing of DOE scrap metal that may have residual surface radioactivity. Carbon steel and stainless steel are primarily at issue, but the policy to be developed would also cover aluminum, lead, and precious metals. And, as Kelly Ramirez reports, those radioactive scrap metals could wind up in a host of household products.
There is currently a moratorium on disposing radioactive metals from certain types of DOE facilities. The impact statement would consider various disposition alternatives, continuing the moratorium, lifting the moratorium and allowing release of radioactive metals under existing rules, or allowing release under different rules. DOE contends that the radiation levels at issue are very low, just above natural background levels. But very low is still not safe to Dr. John Goffman, medical doctor, nuclear physicist, and author of the book Radiation and Human Health.
The whole idea about toxic materials is, first, never produce them if you can possibly avoid it. They violated that already. Once you produce them, the next problem is it's your obligation to segregate this material. So the statement by Doe that it's low level, just knock that off. We're not interested in hearing from Doe about what's low level. There is no safe dose of radiation. Poisons are to be contained, not spread into the biosphere.
Public interest groups and the metals industry are concerned that radioactive metals and other DOE radioactive waste, such as soil, concrete, and plastic, might be recycled into building materials and household products, such as kitchen utensils. Bill Heenan is president of the Steel Recycling Institute.
Well, the Steel Recycling Institute, along with the steel industry and the scrap industry, have been advocates of stopping the free release of any of this scrap into the production stream. And we've done this because we're concerned about the outcome of what happens when we release this scrap into the production stream. The government needs to decontaminate this material and then use it only maybe to bury other solid waste or other hazardous waste, make containers out of it so we can do that with the material. This is a joint effort of the metals industry, the aluminum industry, the nickel industry, the chrome industry, the steel industry, the iron industry are all in the same position of opposing the free release of this material.
DOE's process for developing the policy is also coming under fire. Bowing to public pressure, the department recently canceled a contract with a company it hired to study the impact of recycling scrap metal from nuclear sites. The company, San Diego-based Science Applications International Corporation, had worked as a subcontractor at DOE's Oak Ridge, Tennessee Nuclear Reservation, where its job was to help the primary contractor navigate the regulatory process involved in recycling scrap metal. DOE filed a notice of intent to create the impact statement in the July 12th Federal Register. The notice announced 6 regional public meetings. The first 2, in North Augusta, South Carolina, and Oak Ridge, Tennessee, have already taken place. The remaining meetings are August 7th in Oakland, California, August 9th in Richland, Washington, August 14th in Cincinnati, Ohio, and August 16th in Arlington, Virginia. Public Citizen, a public interest organization founded by Ralph Nader, is accusing DOE of trying to minimize public input. Winona Howder directs the Critical Mass Energy and Environment Program of Public Citizen.
It's ridiculous to think that during August, a heavy vacation month, that the public could be involved in this so-called public process. And the locations that have been selected are almost all in DOE facility communities. So, for instance, Oak Ridge, Tennessee, the one in Oakland is one of the ones that is actually in an area that has a large population, but it's being held out at an airport without adequate public transportation. And it's obvious that the DOE doesn't really want public participation. They just want to meet the letter of the law and say they've fulfilled their legal obligation without really getting comments.
Howder is urging the public to attend the meetings and make comments.
People don't need to give technical comments. This is a very common sense type of thing. They need to say that this is outrageous and that the DOE shouldn't release the materials.
Phone calls to the Department of Energy were not returned. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
Facing what might be easily characterized as the biggest battle of his career, Martin Luther King III told a crowd gathered this week at the SCLC convention in Montgomery that he's not his father. "I don't have my father's melodious voice," he said. "God only gave South Africa one Mandela. God only gave the United States one Martin Luther King. God has seen fit to give me just a flicker of the flame. I'm going to let it shine," said the 43-year-old King. Members of the audience waved "We love you, Martin" signs. But critics of Marty King know all too well the differences between the famous Baptist orator and his son, the embattled leader of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the cornerstone organization for the 1960s civil rights struggle. Dissenters in the SCLC have reportedly called him an absent, ineffective leader. Board Chair Claude Young sent King a letter in May criticizing his inability to raise money, lack of communication, unexplained stints away from the Atlanta office, and failure to set a clear agenda for the organization. Young has since backed off and said that the matter has been resolved, and during a brief speech Sunday night, he promised to support the SCLC leadership. Ernie Suggs is a reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution who's been following the internal struggles of the SCLC and is in Montgomery this week for the convention. He spoke with Verna Avery Brown.
Last night during his presidential address, I mean, he delivered perhaps the best speech I've ever seen him make. And, you know, he was impassioned. He had a focus. He presented the agenda for what he wants to accomplish during the next couple of years as president of the SCLC. So I think based on all the controversy, I think it kind of raised him to another level. It kind of forced him to get up to another level. But when you say his birthright, you know, he had a lot of people in support of him last night and throughout this weekend. As you know, the convention is still going on. But, you know, his mother was there last night on the dais with him, Jesse Jackson, Joseph Lowry, Walter Fauntroy, Andrew Young was there, Dick Gregory. So he pulled a lot of heavy hitters. A lot of heavy hitters came out to show support for him last night. And I think that based on last night's presentation, I think it's evident that he has a lot of support and enough support to stick around as president.
He certainly did have himself cloaked in support from the longtime civil rights veterans, as you've just articulated, people that are basically the founders of the movement. How long can this old guard loyalty carry him, though?
I think it's going to carry him for a while. He is the son of Martin Luther King Jr., and I think that carries a lot of weight. Regardless of what his resume is, the top thing on that resume is the fact that he's Martin Luther King Jr.'s son. And I think based on that, based largely on the fact that he is a son, a lot of people are going to be reluctant to get rid of him as president. If he continues to do a bad job in the eyes of the board, then maybe something that's going to have to be changed. But I think that right now, based on the amount of support that he has from the old guard, he's going to be able to stick around for a while. And, you know, even some of the board members last night or during the week have been on and off the record stating that, you know, it's time to move on. You know, he's our president. We're going to support him. And it may be a chance for them to relook at their board structure. And perhaps even, you know, there has been talk about Claude Young leaving and about him, you know, resigning from the board. So I don't think Martin Luther King III is going to leave until he's basically ready.
Well, what about the issues that Claude Young raised? Does the SCLC, under the leadership of Martin Luther King III, have any kind of specific social agenda to speak of?
Martin Luther King III has not set a clear agenda for this organization. The only thing that he basically has done, he's addressed racial profiling, which is a pretty big thing. He helped bring attention to George's need to get rid of the Confederate base flag, which are, so those are two of the major things he's done. But as far as other things, as far as teen pregnancy, as far as AIDS in the black community, as far as a lot of different issues that you would traditionally think about when you think about civil rights organizations, the SCLC can be accused of not being at the forefront of these things like the NAACP or Rainbow Push has over the last 3 or 4 years. So a lot of what Claude Young has said, people are agreeing that it's true. The organization has not moved forward as the way it should. But still, on the other hand, people are still, based upon what's going on at this meeting this weekend, still willing to support Martin Luther King, and hopefully with the agenda he laid out last night in terms of fighting poverty through technology and economic development and educational development, that he can move the organization forward.
How do you read the future of this organization?
Well, that's a good question. I think that civil rights organizations have to be communicators, and I think that when they do their job well, you know, you don't have battles now in terms of fighting Klansmen, hooded Klansmen, and talking about lynchings and things like that, you have new agendas and new avenues to confront. And I think that, for one, if these civil rights organizations communicate and inform people about racial profiling and AIDS in the black community and police brutality and inequitable job treatment, if they do that and if they fight those fights and if they do it well, then I think they have a clear future. But if they don't, if they're just standing by on their name and swooping into town when the media is there, then they're not going to survive. So I think the SCLC has to basically determine which path they're going to take and in order for them to survive. Because right now, I think that the organization is old. The organization has been slow for a while, and unless Marty King is able to reinvigorate the organization with new, younger members, with progressive members, then it's just going to suffer like it has been over the last couple of years.
Ernie Suggs is a reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution who's been following the internal struggles of the SCLC. He spoke with Verna Avery Brown. This week in Penticton, British Columbia, about 1,200 people gathered for the 12th annual Protecting Mother Earth Conference, organized by the Indigenous Environmental Network. With energy policy and lumber agreements taking center stage in both North and South America, the natural resources owned by Indigenous peoples are increasingly under development pressure. But as conference speakers pointed out, resource extraction brings environmental consequences that directly harm Indigenous people and indirectly harm everyone else. For example, British Columbia's forests are now suffering from their worst beetle infestation that the David Suzuki Foundation says is a consequence of clear-cutting. The conference also talked about toxins in the food supply, sustainable agriculture, toxic waste incinerators, decolonization, and sustainable forestry. Thatcher Collins reports from Penticton in the Okanagan Nation.
President Bush's energy plan would allow drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and much of Saturday's panel was devoted to oil drilling. Norma Cassie of the Gwich'in Nation near the refuge spoke about how her area has seen an unprecedented series of December rains that freezes over, covering tundra vegetation needed by caribou. To people in the Arctic, global warming and toxins are a reality.
And we're going to fight and we're going to do whatever we possibly can to stop this development in the calving grounds and in the Arctic. They're wanting to string a pipeline right through the Arctic Ocean and all the Arctic ice that's moving right now. There's no way that a pipeline can sustain underneath that ocean. About 7 or 8 years ago, the oceanographers of the world got together in the central United States and declared the oceans of the world toxic. That is why when we hang up our salmon now, it spoils fast. Even the ways that we prepare our food. The caribou, the marrow is watery now. They have black under their eyes. They're not energetic like they used to be. They're not fat like they used to be. The salmon in the Yukon Territory has a very high level of chlordane, which is very toxic contaminant.
Brian Hirsch of Energy Earth Systems works with the Gwich'in in Alaska.
There's a lot of conferences and things I've seen down in the Dakotas, for example, where there is a lot of wind power. And tribes have a lot of land base where they can develop that wind, for example. But if it's not tribally run and tribally controlled, you folks aren't going to get a lot of benefits out of it.
The conference expanded this year to include Indigenous people from South America. Among them was Luz Cosama from the Quechua Nation in Colombia.
Observamos cómo a un pueblo de una zona llamada la Serranía del Perijá.
People of the Serranía de Perijal, the oil companies came in and wiped out an entire people. In the 1950s and 60s, they also ended another culture. The Wajibo people had their entire culture wiped out by fumigations, by oil companies, and by the rubber boom.
The Native Youth Movement has taken direct action over environmental issues, and the British Columbia chapters have been especially active in the last few years. Kiwe led a workshop on movement building describing past actions.
There was a roadblock in Chiam of the year 2000, spring 2000. We blocked an access road that a lot of the local sports fishermen used, and we reclaimed three of the islands on the Fraser River for the Chiam band. Campaign after that, we went to Vancouver Island to a place called Alert Bay. And there's a lot of fish farms that have been popping up in their territory, and the Indigenous people in that area, they complained that the fish that were being introduced into their habitat was destroying the natural stock that was there. So we went and we evicted the fish farms out of their territory.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Thatcher Collins in Penticton.
President Bush is in Crawford, Texas today, starting off the first week of a month-long vacation on his 1,600-acre Central Texas ranch. While kicking back and relaxing, the Republican president will also be plotting how to fine-tune his strategy to reinforce what his advisors say is his commitment to issues like education, as Democrats increasingly portray him as the voice of the Republican right wing, beholden to special interests and out of touch with mainstream America. The Bush education plan originally stressed private school vouchers and now focuses on high-stakes standardized testing and performance awards for high-performing teachers and schools. Free Speech Radio News' Ellen Ratner recently talked to Bush's education secretary, Rod Page, about the president's education plan and has these thoughts.
When George Bush brought Houston school superintendent Rod Page to Washington to serve as Secretary of Education, the administration touted Page as a reformer with results, crediting him with dramatically improving the quality of education in the Houston schools. Page's school system was one of the inspirations for Bush's national education plan. Even though the president's education plan has changed substantially since its inception, Page's devotion to the president's plan has not wavered. He preaches the benefits of school testing to anyone who will listen.
Well, there are examples of poor tests, but we're not talking about poor tests. We're talking about tests that are authentic, valid, fair tests. And we think those tests should measure standards that every child has had an opportunity to achieve.
Democrats have pointed to the difficulty in testing and accountability on a federal level for an education system that receives over 90% of its funding from the localities and states. The administration, however, believes that the answers to our education woes are simple, with solutions lying in accountability and testing. Ironically, critics see the plan's simplicity as its inherent flaw, and they are demanding additional funding that Democrats believe is the only path to real education reform. Page has consistently dismissed this idea.
You know, one of the things that I think that bothers me most is the linkage between performance and funding. You know, the assumption seems to be that if the school is low performing, that the problem is money. Sometimes that's true, and many times it is not.
The initial romance with Page, the reformer, seems to have faded away. Rumors have circulated that the administration has considered dismissing him, which perhaps explains why Page seems at pains to walk lockstep with the president on education reform. Regardless, neither the administration nor Secretary Page has managed to create a focused message on education. Even Secretary Page at times seems unsure of the message he is trying to project, as appears to be the case with the issue of pay for teachers.
I think that the entire structure of teacher compensation should be examined, and that there should be some linkage between performance and contribution. And obviously, those that have the most challenging situation, that should be part of the consideration in setting up the system. Teachers are underpaid, and I believe that we will need to change the structure of this in order to get the salaries of teachers up to where they deserve to be.
Bush's education plan will be fiercely debated in Congress, where Democrats will almost certainly make the legislation's passage contingent on additional funding for schools and school buildings. The man with the most at stake, however, could be Page, who has staked his credibility on selling the president's education proposal. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Ellen Ratner.
Free Speech Radio News is produced by Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. I'm Matt Martin, filling in for Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow.